You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
On October 7th, 2001, the United States launched its invasion of Afghanistan. Within 2 months, it had conquered much of the country. Then it set to work apparently rebuilding the country and the government. That was 9 years ago. In the intervening years, NATO countries have spent hundreds of billions of dollars. 2,100 NATO soldiers have been killed, including 152 Canadians. The number of civilian casualties is harder to come by, but it easily exceeds the number of military deaths. The question arises, what do the United States and its allies have to show for all of the lives lost and the money spent? Derek O'Keefe is a social activist. He is also co-author with Malalai Joya of A Woman Among Warlords, and he's joined me in the studio to discuss the current situation in Afghanistan. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning.
Recently, Afghanistan held a round of parliamentary elections. What happened there? How did they go?
Well, we can maybe put the elections in air quotes. These were really selections more than elections. So just to give you an example from a New York Times report on September 25th of the elections that took place a week before September 18th. The headline was "Widespread Fraud Seen in Latest Afghan Elections." And just to give you a small sample of that, over one-third of the provinces' results were affected by the fraud. There were videos of ballot stuffing, intimidation of election officials. One video surfaced, and you know, Afghanistan is not a country where everyone has cell phone video recorders, but nevertheless, a lot of incriminating videos showed up. There was one video showed election officials haggling with a candidate, a campaign manager, candidate rep, over the price of votes. And this was even widely reported before the election, again in the New York Times, not in a fringe leftist or independent source. The New York Times was reporting that in different provinces of Afghanistan, a vote had a different price. So it was widely acknowledged that these spots in parliament were basically for sale. And in that kind of circumstance, you're obviously going to get a lot of drug traffickers, a lot of warlords getting into the parliament. Now, they have, you know, they did come out with something like, I think, 47% as a voter turnout, which is comparable to an election in the West. But I would take that with a large grain of salt. And I'll tell you why. One district, Paktika, had a turnout of 626%.
Very impressive.
And several provinces recorded a voter turnout over 100%. And this is because there was massive scale counterfeiting of the voter cards. So the real turnout was very, very low, and there was just a massive amount of fraud, which is just a continuation of what we saw with last year's presidential election. So I think even amongst the U.S. officials and NATO officials, these elections, it's basically admitted that they're not very credible and that there's a huge amount of corruption going on.
What about dissident Afghan activist Malalai Joya? She was elected to parliament 5 years ago. Did she run again this time?
She decided not to run. And remember, she ran in 2005, was elected overwhelmingly for Faro province, and then was kicked out 2 years later. And even when she was in parliament, given her politics, which were strongly against the warlords and against the NATO war, she was often silenced. Her mic was routinely cut off. She faced threats in the parliament, violent attacks by other parliamentarians in the parliamentary buildings. And then they kicked her out entirely. So she fought for 2 years to be reinstated, and there was an international campaign. The Afghan government sort of indicated vaguely that they would let her run this time, but she and others like-minded decided that they would sit this process out, that, you know, even these parliamentary elections had no validity in the eyes of the Afghan people, and that it was better to carry out a struggle for democracy and a struggle against the occupation by other means. So there are very few people will be in this new parliament that have that are real legitimate representatives of the aspirations of the Afghan people. You know, that was the case in 2005, but it's even worse now, I think, with this new parliament coming in. So Joya decided to sit out, and her quote, which was widely reported, was that this parliament will be made up of lawbreakers, not lawmakers.
Turning to the continuing war in Afghanistan, recently a U.S. soldier charged with murdering civilians in Afghanistan made his first court appearance. Can you tell us about those events?
A number of U.S. soldiers from an infantry division have been charged with war crimes, murder, and they are accused of basically killing for sport. They're accused of mutilating the dead bodies of Afghans, of keeping body parts as trophies, horrifying stuff. And this has come out now. This was originally reported in The Guardian, I believe, but now has been widely picked up. The really disturbing thing about this, the thing I found most disturbing, was that one Christopher Winfield, who was the father of one of the now accused, had been trying to warn the Army about this for many months. Since February, it was reported that he was doing an online chat with his son, who got some time online, and his son said in this online chat, basically said that we've been killing innocent people. And he said, quote, "We just killed some innocent guy about my age who was just farming." So the father, and then the online chat ended, and the father was apoplectic, very concerned about his son and what he had been involved in, what his division had been involved in, because his son was not directly involved in this killing that was being reported on the chat room. So he was trying to tell the Army, he was trying to get in touch with the Army about this incident for many months, and the Army just ignored him. Until, you know, evidence came out by other means, and they finally had to arrest this group that had obviously been running rampant throughout the year. And it's of great concern. If this is what's happening in an infantry division, which is, you know, a part of the Army that has at least some oversight and some rules of engagement, we have to really wonder what's happening in the special forces war and also what's being done by the different mercenary companies and private militias. One of the things that really came through in the WikiLeaks documents, WikiLeaks released over 70,000 classified documents over the summer, was the extent to which the war in Afghanistan is being fought by special forces. And related to the special forces are the companies like Blackwater and other mercenary corporations who are working hand in glove with the CIA and other U.S. agencies to wage this war. And they don't have the same kind of oversight as an infantry division. And, you know, these are killers. These are paid killers. So the type of thing that is going on, killing for sport within this infantry division, we can imagine is much more widespread throughout both the open war and the secret war in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. So we might be tempted to say, oh, look, it's good they're actually trying and charging these soldiers who have acted this way. But the reality is this kind of thing is going on a much wider scale than we'll ever know about.
Now, I understand that the attorney for the accused soldier said that Private Morlock and the other soldiers were victims of a failed policy. Do you see soldiers like Morlock as victims of misguided government policy?
I don't know the exact what Morlock is accused of or the others. Like I said, some of the accused are accused of being part of a cover-up for being part of the division that carried out these massacres. I think a lot of the soldiers are victims in many ways, in the way that they're recruited through an economic draft, you know, especially today in the United States, especially where there are so few opportunities in many parts of the country, and this is where the recruiters go and target these young men and women and recruit them. But at the same time, occupying a country militarily is a breeding ground or a natural environment for sociopaths. So I think people who have latent sociopathic tendencies will find themselves will naturally be drawn to situations where they can kill with impunity. So while I do think that many soldiers are victimized and that there is an economic draft in the United States, I think you have a lot of very, very sick people over there, especially in the mercenary companies. These are people who kill for a living and have for many, many years. And they're taking advantage of really a climate of impunity that this U.S. policy is allowing, U.S. and Canadian policy. Another interesting thing that came out recently was that the Canadian military is still using training services from Blackwater. So long after Blackwater has been discredited internationally, the Canadian military has been continuing to go down there to their training camps in Carolina every year and pay Blackwater for training services. If you can believe it, one of the things that came out recently is that the Canadian forces were paying Blackwater to create the cultural conditions of Afghanistan. So they would go down there for a camping trip and pretend to be Afghan insurgents. I think it was called Operation Mirror. a training program where Canadian forces go down. And Blackwater brings in Farsi and Pashto speakers, and they get to pretend they're in Afghanistan out in the woods in Carolina. And for these services, our taxpayer money here in Canada is being paid to this this brutal mercenary company, Blackwater. And that came out in the press maybe a month ago, and I haven't heard anything in Parliament about it, any real widespread outrage. So it's very disturbing, all of the links. You know, I've been talking about a lot of what the U.S. is doing in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but Canada is completely, completely enmeshed in this policy.
Now the Harper government has committed Canadians to be in Afghanistan until 2011. What do you think is going to happen after that time?
Well, unfortunately, it looks very much like they're finding a way to stay. They will probably bring back the combat groups, the 2,500 or now more that have been in Kandahar since, I guess, 2005, when they were first transferred down to Kandahar. In many ways, that capacity for the Canadian military is exhausted, but they do want to find a different way of staying and supporting the NATO occupation of Afghanistan. And what's emerging now is a so-called training mission, where they'll leave as many as several hundred or more troops in Kabul or other locations in Afghanistan. And the Liberal Party sort of came out pushing this. Actually, right now, in terms of public statements, the Liberals under Ignatieff have been more aggressive in saying, look, we need to stay and finish the job in Afghanistan. We need to keep a military presence there as quote-unquote trainers. But if anyone knows the history of the U.S. in Vietnam or the history of imperial interventions in general, when you stay somewhere offering military training, you're really occupying the country and you're continuing the war by other means. So I think that's what we can look for this fall in Parliament, is some kind of agreement. Unfortunately, it may get all-party consensus to stay in a training capacity. We haven't heard much opposition from the NDP of late about this sort of effort to continue Canada's presence in Afghanistan.
A couple of weeks ago, we spoke on Red Eye with anti-war activist Kathy Kelly in the States about the issue of drones and their protest against drones being used by the American Army. What role do drones play a role in the situation of Afghanistan?
As far as I know, the drone attacks are primarily on the Pakistan side of the border. I believe they're also using drones for surveillance and for other missions in Afghanistan. But essentially, the U.S.-NATO war is not respecting Pakistani sovereignty in any way. And this has even upset the Pakistani government, which is very servile to the U.S. in general and very inept in the eyes of its own people. They just had this massive flooding disaster. But even during the floods, where 20 million people were homeless, the U.S. drone attacks continued. And the Pakistani government sort of made these formal complaints. But they're basically allowing the U.S. to continue to violate their sovereignty and make these attacks. Now, it has its limits. This past week, some helicopter gunship attacks by NATO killed Pakistani border guards. So there's all kinds of collateral damage. Sometimes they kill civilians. This time they killed Pakistani border guards. So in protest, Pakistan has actually shut down one of the main U.S. supply routes from Pakistan into Afghanistan. So for a week, that border has been closed down by the Pakistanis to protest this continuing violation of their sovereignty. But the drone attacks are escalating more generally. Most of the drone attacks are in Waziristan, and in September, keep in mind, again, Pakistan is still suffering massively from this flooding disaster. In September, there were more drone attacks than any other month in the war. So the biggest humanitarian crisis in a century in Pakistan is no impediment to the U.S. continuing to wage this drone war. And predictably, it's not having the effect of turning people in these tribal areas of Pakistan into U.S. Supporters. This past week, all of the markets in the big cities in Waziristan, or all the major towns, shut down their markets completely in protest of the drone attacks. So they're completely counterproductive, even from a point of view of getting Pakistanis or people in these areas on side with the U.S. So it's just another one of the irrational, brutal aspects of this war that just seems to keep expanding.
Real Aid True Solidarity, that's the name of a benefit that's being held by Stop War in Vancouver. What's the goal of the benefit?
We are planning to do fundraising on two fronts, and we should mention that we're fortunate that Malalai Joya will be back in town, and she'll be one of the featured speakers there. So one of the things we want to do is to raise money for a hospital that her supporters help run. It's a free medical clinic in Farah province of Afghanistan. So we'll be raising money for that, and we'll also be raising money for the Canadian boat to Gaza, which is part of an international effort to break the siege of Gaza with the Free Gaza Movement. We want to educate people about the general topics of war and occupation in Palestine and Afghanistan and other parts of the region, but we also thought it'd be good to raise money specifically for projects that challenge Canadian foreign policy in the area. This isn't like a charitable fundraiser. We really want to raise money for efforts that are attempting to restore self-determination and dignity to people in this part of the world. So the Canadian boat to Gaza, for instance, we don't just want to take supplies there. People are suffering, but we want to, the Canadian boat aims to go there and then take products made in Gaza out for export. Because one of the things the siege does that people don't know is that it prevents all exports from Gaza, has basically killed the economy. And similarly, with raising money for the hospital that Malalai Joya is associated with, this is the kind of project that Canadian aid and the Karzai government never seem to get around to funding in any way. So we want to do our part and through grassroots fundraising to make this hospital keep running.
Okay, sounds fantastic. Thank you for joining me.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
Derek O'Keefe is a social activist. He is the co-author with Malalai Joya of A Woman Among Warlords. And the anti-war benefit Real Aid True Solidarity will be held on Tuesday, October 12th at W2 Storium, and it starts at 7 p.m. And W2 is at 151 West Cordova. That's between Cambie and Abbott. Tickets are $10 to $20, and they're available at People's Co-op Books on Commercial Drive, or you can get them at the door.